You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2018/2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Now for the continuation of this month's cover story, Super Fragilistic Lin-Manuel Miranda by Bruce Handy, with photographs by Andres Kudake, Ethan James Green, and styled by Samira Nasser. Next photo, Top of the Ladder. Legacy and what you leave behind are in the fabric of a lot of the things that Lin makes, says Thomas Kail. And here Miranda appears on top of a ladder. His parents' record collection is a big part of Miranda's own origin story. The show tunes from Broadway cast albums they'd relax to, and the salsa and merengue they'd play at dance parties, both strains entwining to form his musical DNA, along with the hip-hop he absorbed as a kid, which served as a kind of accelerant. Another key influence, seeing Rent on his 17th birthday. Jonathan Larson connected the dots in musicals that this thing you love can reflect the world in which you live. I loved musicals, but they never reflected the world in which I lived. It was just a separate thing I liked. He connected those dots for me, and I think I really started writing and felt like I could write a musical because of Jonathan Larson. Which makes Miranda's directing a movie version of Tick, Tick, Boom a form of debt service. Larson's autobiographical show, its earliest version, first performed off-Broadway in 1990, centers on a marginally successful musical theater composer who is contemplating giving it up as his 30th birthday looms. The stage production opened to the literal sound of a ticking clock. The show has a happy ending, but it's impossible not to view it through the bitter lens of Larson's shocking death in 1996 from an aortic aneurysm at the age of 35, the morning of Rent's first off-Broadway performance, which is about as cruelly ironic as death gets in real life. Rent, of course, is stalked by death, too, in the form of HIV/AIDS. Everything's been preparing me to direct Tick, Tick, Boom, Miranda continued, both from my upbringing with Jonathan Larson's music and from my understanding of what it's like to be a struggling composer in your 20s, trying to get your show on and trying to get a different vocabulary heard, trying to get Broadway to sound more like the world you actually live in. Which was Jonathan's whole quest, and he succeeded in spades, and he didn't get to see that success. But for me, what I love most about Tick, Tick, Boom is it's not about Jonathan Larson's death at all. It's really about his struggle, about coming to New York and being the one who still bangs your head against the wall while your friends have gone into maybe cashier jobs or diverted their dreams into finding something else they love to do. We all have our version of that. In a 2015 New Yorker profile of Miranda that ran just as Hamilton premiered at the Public Theater, Rebecca Mead wrote that during rehearsals for the Broadway run of Heights, Miranda developed the superstition that he would die before opening night. As he told Mead, it was like a running joke. Unknown composer falls down manhole. Unknown composer hit by bus. I raised this with him, and the obvious connection to Larson's life, work, and death, and to Miranda's doomed Alexander Hamilton. And Bob Fosse's got the ticking clock, too, he pointed out, bringing up his pending FX series. Indeed, Fosse's 1979 quasi-autobiographical movie musical, All That Jazz, ends with an audacious, spectacularly bizarre 10-minute number about the Fosse character's fatal heart attack. Bye-bye, life. To the tune of the Everly Brothers' Bye Bye Love. Fosse, Larson, Hamilton, they've all got this awareness of the ticking clock, Miranda continued, and I think I very much have that. The awareness of, all right, this is how much time we have. How much can we get done while we're here? I ask whether that urgency had been fostered by his teenage connection to Larson's work, or whether it was something he'd felt his whole life. Well, I think the tragedy that Larson did not get to see his own legacy resonated with me enormously, but it was his worth that I really responded to, more than his passing. I felt so seen by the character of Mark in Rent when I first saw it, the guy who just films everything because he doesn't really want to engage. That's what I was like in high school. I had a big-ass camcorder, and I would film all my friends when they were hanging out. I literally have footage of my friends eating snacks and being like, why are you filming? Because it was easier for me than sitting and hanging out. I don't know what hanging out is. He added, for what it's worth, I've relaxed a lot more since I was a teenager. But most teenagers and people in their early 20s are fairly heedless about risk and death. Famously, often tragically so. What, I pressed, fueled his rare sense of urgency. He paused for just a moment, then said, matter-of-factly, I had a close friend who passed away when I was about 3 years old. That's among my earlier memories. It was a kid who was in my class, in pre-K. It was one of those tragic things. I asked if he minded explaining what had happened. It's really sort of not my story to tell, he replied, but she drowned. It was just one of those horrible stories where no one had an eye on her in a critical moment, and that happened. No one's fault. It's just what happened. He said all this with a subdued evenness in his voice, but then his switch turned on again. There's an extraordinary moment in the Harry Potter books. It's like the fifth book, where Harry gets into the carriage to take them all to Hogwarts Castle, and he sees these giant invisible horses. And no one else sees them. He's like, what are those? And only one girl, Luna Lovegood, knows that those are Thestrals. Only people who have seen death can see those. Harry and Luna are the only two kids on this thing who can see that. So I loved that metaphor, because I saw Thestrals really early. When dying is concrete, and it's someone you played in the sandbox with, I think it becomes very real in a way. I'm sure that's a central part of it for me. Earlier, when we were talking about his book of Twitter affirmations and his fear of being pigeonholed as inspirational, Miranda had to ask, "What if I want to write a dark dystopian thing next?" It was a rhetorical question. Alas, he's not working on a dark dystopian musical. This was just something he might do in theory, he said, but I don't doubt he could create a really grim one if he ever wanted. Next photos, how far he'll go. Miranda in Washington, D.C., with his father, Luis Miranda. Marchers protesting family separation. Families belong together. March participants. Miranda has a brief patter number in Mary Poppins Returns, a kind of music hall, proto-rap, because, of course. Otherwise, as Rob Marshall said, it would be like having Fred Astaire and not having him dance. You need to highlight what someone's great gifts are. Similarly, you don't interview Lin-Manuel Miranda and not ask about his favorite movie musicals, ones he might be drawing ideas from now that he would soon be directing his own. In terms of movie scores, I like the old ones the best, he replied. I like MGM. I always used to joke that if the last scene of my life was the last scene of the Bandwagon, Vincente Minnelli's 1953 backstage musical, I would have lived a very wonderful life. The scene is Fred Astaire thinks no one's coming to the opening night party for his show, and he sings, "I'll go my way by myself." And he comes out, and everyone you've seen throughout the movie, everyone he loves, sings, "For he's a jolly good fellow." If that's the last scene of my life, I will have lived a very, very happy life. Framing his love of the Bandwagon as his own deathbed, huzzah, maybe a better version of Bye Bye Life, seemed quintessentially Mirandian, the cheerleader with a fatalistic streak. He would, in fact, get something close to the Astaire treatment when he and other members of the In the Heights cast and creative team appeared for a special event at a Barnes & Noble to celebrate the re-release of the cast album in a 10th anniversary vinyl box set. Fans had lined up on the sidewalk the previous evening, and half an hour before things were scheduled to start, the store's event space was jammed with the allotted 500 or so lucky attendees, all wearing wristbands, buzzing and jostling, spilling back into the aisles of books, and singing along lustily as the show's tunes played on the PA system. Most were high school age or even younger, kids who might have been only 6 or 7 when the Broadway production closed in 2011. Judging from the relatively on-key vocalizing, the theater geek contingent was well represented. I repeat, this was a promotional event for the vinyl release of a decade-old cast album. How many in attendance even owned a turntable? Miranda and his colleagues entered to screams and raised phones. Miranda, wearing a newsboy cap, looked sheepish but thrilled. He and the others took their places on a riser and answered questions from an MC, who eventually opened things up to the audience. The first person to ask a question was a teenage girl overcome with emotion. "Lynn," she began, drawing a deep breath, and then in a rush, "you are my greatest influence. And when I was alone, you were my dearest friend. I was so inspired by your immigrant stories, I wrote my own." She started crying and managed to get out. "I wouldn't be alive without you, I swear." "It's okay," Miranda said, raising his voice an octave higher, comically, to diffuse the emotion, but he was also palpably moved. Afterward, I went over to the girl, who was there with her aunt. She told me that her name was Fliss, that she was 16, that she was of a mixed Hispanic and Caribbean heritage, and that, at the time she had discovered In the Heights, through the cast album and videos, her life had been in lots of turmoil. The aunt nodded sympathetically, encouragingly. Turmoil clearly encompassed a lot of pain, maybe loss. It felt wrong to probe any further. "I thought my life didn't have value," Fliss continued. In the Heights had connected her to her Hispanic roots, had shown her that her own story mattered. "It lifted me up," she said, speaking confidently, hesitancy and tears gone. "Who lives? Who dies? Who tells your story?" as the lyric from Hamilton goes. Maybe Fliss will learn from Miranda the way he took inspiration from Larson. We'll see. But if this had indeed been the last scene of Miranda's life, it would have been a pretty good one. Instead, he and his colleagues ended up staying at the store for 2 more hours, signing albums for a long, snaking line of people who had shelled out $50 for the 3-LP set. And not a week after that, he headed off to Wales to start filming his Dark Materials, the flame still lit, the engine still running, the clock still ticking. the 2018 Hall of Fame. Oh, what a stormy year. While many of the nation's leaders went low, these unconventional heroes went high, taking risk and taking a stand. Here, reviving a Vanity Fair tradition, we nominate a group of newsmakers for our annual Hall of Fame, photographed by Annie Leibovitz. Lady and the Trump by Christopher Buckley. Stephanie Clifford, a lifelong equestrian, rides Casalto in West Grove, Pennsylvania. It was a blonde, Raymond Chandler wrote in Farewell, My Lovely. A blonde to make a bishop kick a hole in a stained glass window. Stormy Daniels, real name Stephanie Gregory Clifford, the face that launched 1,000 memes, Yeti pubes, Mario Kart mushroom dick, may bring down the whole building. Trump's fixer, Michael, I'd take a bullet for him, Cohen, may go to jail, in part, because he never got his client to sign the damned non-disclosure form, making that $130,000 the loudest hush money in American history. Sad. The Donald allegedly promised to make her a star on The Apprentice, but didn't. Bad. She became the star of her own reality show, the only stripper to open her act with a clip from 60 Minutes. Say what you will, but she's funny. She considered running for the U.S. Senate on the slogan Stormy Daniels, screwing people honestly. And she's got taste. Every time she sees the leader of the free world on TV, she thinks, I had sex with that? Ugh. Thank you. the 2018 Hall of Fame, The Visionary, by Dee Rees. In the photo, Ryan Coogler and trick-or-treaters in Limerick Park, Los Angeles. The radical genius of Ryan Coogler's Black Panther lies not just in its world creation, but in its daring specificity of a world where women are warriors, women are counselors, women are scientific savants, where children are as wise and respected as the ancestors, where the past is precisely as urgent and immediate as the future. Coogler's world is layered with complicated technology that is not simply powered by isn't it cool spectacle, but by a profound and constantly oscillating dissonance of philosophy to help or to hide, outreach versus isolation, community versus supremacy. The fact that there are no easy answers points to Coogler's keen intellect behind the storytelling and is part of the reason why Black Panther is now and forever will be a superlative of the superhero canon. But perhaps most stunningly, through his revolutionary imagination, Ryan Coogler has irrevocably recast who can be king, who can be warrior, who can be hero. We can. The 2018 Hall of Fame, The Advocate by Mariska Hargitay. In the photo, Judge Aquilina at Veterans Memorial Courthouse in Lansing, Michigan. Justice requires action and a voice, said the Honorable Judge Rosemary Aquilina to Larry Nassar, the disgraced doctor who molested scores of women and girls during his decades-long tenure at USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University, before sentencing him to 40 to 175 years in prison. Judge Aquilina's voice is unmistakable, as dynamic, opinionated, and strong as it is empathic, compassionate, and imbued with emotion. Even more remarkable than the power of her voice, "I speak out because I want change," she says, is the room she made for survivors' voices during Nassar's sentencing hearing. 156 victim impact statements spanning 7 gut-wrenching days. Olympic gold medalist Allie Raisman has said piercingly, "All we needed was one adult to have the integrity to stand between us and Larry Nassar." Whereas those who could have prevented so much harm were lamentably silent, Judge Aquilina has shown a steadfast commitment to righting this wrong, signaling to all that abuse will not be tolerated, that the world must be made safer for women to speak up, and that healing through justice is possible. As she told the brave women in her courtroom, "Leave your pain here and go out and do your magnificent things." the 2018 Hall of Fame, The Field Marshal, by Dave Eggers. In the photo, Kylian Mbappe at Camp des Loges in Saint-Germain-en-Laye, France. In Russia, he became the youngest Frenchman to ever score a goal in a World Cup. A few days later, when he scored two goals against Argentina, he became only the second teenager, after Pelé, to score two goals in one cup match. Playing against Croatia in the final, Kylian Mbappe blasted a comet from 25 yards out, helping France win the whole thing. Mbappe was still 19 when, a few weeks after being feted by Macron and Putin amid a sudden Russian rain, he signed a contract with Paris Saint-Germain worth about $210 million, making him the most expensive teenager in the world. All this, and his game, is still developing. He's a very good passer, but often doesn't see the wide-open man. He's a phenomenal ball handler, but often makes three feints when one will do. But there is that freakish speed. The soccer world will not soon forget the sight of Mbappe in the round of 16, of charging down the field with half of the Argentinian side chasing him as he eyed an open goal. With every long stride, he seemed to grow faster and taller, and the Argentines, slump-shouldered Messi among them, had to accept the inevitability of a dagger blow and the arrival of a new king.
Thank you.
The 2018 Hall of Fame, The Great Gatsby by Monica Lewinsky. In the photo, Hannah Gadsby, inspired by Picasso's 1906 portrait of Gertrude Stein in Altadena, California. While the comedian Hannah Gadsby has been a national treasure in Australia for more than a decade, she burst into America's consciousness 6 months ago with her paradigm-shifting and thought-provoking Netflix comedy special, Nanette. It's a familiar setup. On stage, a stand-up comic makes a joke at her own expense. The audience laughs, and whatever painful truth she reveals through her anecdote, whatever humiliating, embarrassing, or traumatic experience she hides within the husk of humor is completely forgotten, dismissed, and condoned by the waves of laughter. The brilliance of Hannah and the show is that she refuses to comply with this model. Partway through her act, she declares she's done with comedy because she no longer wants to make jokes out of her suffering. She recounts the harrowing personal ordeals that formed the basis of several of her earlier comedy routines. She forces the audience to sit with these experiences and, in doing so, creates a new framework to understand shame and humiliation. She had us at "There's Nothing Stronger Than a Broken Woman Who Has Rebuilt Herself." That motto, I predict, will be the most popular tattoo of 2019.
Thank you.
the 2018 Hall of Fame. Hear Them Roar by Jacqueline Woodson. In the photo, Naomi Wadler and Gloria Steinem in Brooklyn. With all the stress in the country, we can count on the phenomenal power of girls and women. In March, Naomi Wadler, 12, galvanized tens of thousands of listeners at the March for Our Lives rally in Washington, D.C., with her powerful speech announcing that she was there to represent the African-American girls who are victims of gun violence and too often ignored by the media. One of those captivated by Wadler's words was feminist pioneer Gloria Steinem, 84, who, in 2016, produced a series of 8 documentaries about violence against women around the world. Last spring, Naomi co-chaired her elementary school's walkout to draw attention to the need for stricter gun controls, joining a national movement. Gloria, meanwhile, co-founded and serves on the boards of the Women's Media Center, Equality Now, and Donor Direct Action. In 2013, President Obama awarded Gloria Steinem the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor. No pressure at all, Naomi. Just know, we see you, and the world is so ready for what you're bringing. the 2018 Hall of Fame Paper Trail by Robert Redford. In the photo, Bob Woodward in his home office in Washington. Bob Woodward has long impressed me, calm, unruffled, dogged, and determined to get at the facts. I've followed his journalism career since 1972, as he and Carl Bernstein investigated the Nixon administration. I went on to portray him in the film All the President's Men, which chronicled the Watergate scandal. I've been alarmed and deeply concerned about similar presidential corruption today, which is why of all Bob's books I've read, his latest, Fear, Trump in the White House, might be the most urgent. Revealing an executive branch ruled by greed, feuds, viciousness of spirit, and open warfare against a free press. Once again, Woodward delivers a deeply sourced and rigorously researched account, producing, as he has called journalism itself, the best obtainable version of the truth. Sometimes it's ugly, and often it's shocking. When put to our biggest test, however, our democracy has remained resilient because of our commitment to a free and independent media epitomized by books like his. This is one of the most sacred of our principles, secured by the journalistic bravery required to reveal such hidden truths. Many of the journalists working today were first inspired by Woodward and his passion to serve. His country and its citizens depend on him, and he them. I know Bob doesn't like this attention. True to form, he'd prefer to have his reporting speak for itself. It's still the strongest and most powerful voice he knows. The 2018 Hall of Fame will continue in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.